here's another thing I like to think about. Sitting up there on the hill. I believe that I'm right in this, and if I'm not one of you sailors, correct me. I think that when we stand in a boat at water level, on a clear day, the horizon is 7 miles. I think that's as far as you can see. When you're at water level. Now I'm up maybe 1,000 feet. Above the water level. And on a clear day, my horizon is almost limitless. 150 miles I can see. Sometimes Catalina Island, San Felipe Island, and Point Firmin are all close enough that I can seem like I can skip a rock to them. You know? Just that little bit of elevation changes the horizon from 7 to maybe 150 miles. And we'll be walking up these stairs forever. Now the only thing we can't change about our lives, the only thing that cannot be changed by us, is that we're stuck with ourselves forever. World without end, amen. Now this would be perfect, wouldn't it? We get to thinking about committing suicide, you know. And you can't make it. You can't make it. You're stuck with you forever. Everything else in life isn't changed. You don't even have to go home from here if you don't want to. You can go someplace else. You don't ever have to see your wife again if you don't want to. You don't have to see your kids again if you don't want to. We don't have to stay in California. We don't have to stay in the United States. You can change everything in life but one. You can't get away from you. You're stuck with me forever. I'm stuck with me forever. Now it would appear that when we get here, they would try to teach us how to be friends with ourselves. But they don't. They teach us how we have to work with other people. Be sure that we make a good impression on the neighbors and the people around us. You know? We have to show respect to our elders. Particularly the priest and preacher and the mother-in-law. But they don't tell us how to get along with us, how to become friends with ourselves. Now, in my opinion, sobriety. The definition of sobriety is the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. This is sobriety. Anything short of it is partial sobriety. When I got here, we didn't think of these things. When I got to the program, all of us thought if we hadn't had a drink today, we were sober. And we talked much about putting the plug in the jug, putting the plug in the jug, putting the plug in the jug. I never had any problem putting the plug in the jug. I was pretty honest for 10 years. And after everybody drunk, I put the plug in the jug. Periodic has to get sober. There's no way a periodic can get from getting sober. Because we're pigs. We drink everything there and speak in it too. And we drink it all. The time when it comes when we can't get it down and we can't get it up and we can't live and we can't die. So we have to be sober. So I never had any problem since the blood in the jug. I quit forever. We're from the goddess almost. Put the plug in the jug. My problem was not putting the plug in the jug. It was taking the plug out of the jug. Because when my time came, I put the plug out of the jug. And I was off again. So, physical sobriety is absolutely important. To me, it's synonymous with life. I cannot live and drink, and not myself, I can't keep from drinking. So I have to be physically sober, lest I die. So I am not selling physical sobriety short. It's the foundation under sobriety. The sobriety is physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. Four parts of the same thing, and it adds up to the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously with me. This is sobriety. Now this program is more important to me today than it was 29 years ago. Because 29 years ago, if I could have just died and had it over, it would have been the greatest thing in the world. I was born knowing that suicide wasn't an answer. But it never occurred to me that drinking yourself to death was suicide until I was sober 5 years. So I tried my damnedest to drink myself to death, but I couldn't make it. You can't drink yourself to death if you want to die. The guys that die with alcoholism don't want to die. If we want to drink ourselves to death, we just go nuts and stay nuts, but we can't get over the bridge. I want to make this point. One of the great big insurance companies in the country was built by a man whose son was over in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was an attorney and he was never going in the insurance business. He was going to stay an attorney. And it was a beautiful empire. And I don't know how much effect I had on him, but I've talked with him for a long, long time about getting on in that business and taking over, because his dad was way long in years. And he eventually did. And he was the man that built his empire. And he was pretty old. And he was doing a bit of drinking. And his son talked to him a little about it. And he said, I can drink myself to death if I want to. And his son said, no, you can't. Why, well, he said, so-and-so did. Mentioning another big man in the insurance business who had drunk himself to death. And the lad says, yes, but he didn't want to. And it hit me like a ton of brick, because that's what I was trying to do, but I couldn't make it. The thing that hit me and Alcoholics Anonymous after 25 years, but since I knew I wasn't going to die, I was going to stay insane. And I'd sit there in that chair of mine, thinking about the boys, my boys,
when the kid from the block says, "Where's your dad?" And they say, "He died." And they turn and walk off. Because they couldn't tell him I was in Patton. With just enough left to know how to tie my shoes and why I was there. You know? That kind of dreaming drives you nuts. It drives you nuts. So it's helped to drive me in here. We can't make it if we try. And it never occurred to me until I was 5 years sober that drinking yourself to death was suicide. But of course it is. Now, how am I going to stay sober? I have to be sober. Sobriety and life are synonymous. How am I going to stay sober? I'm going to so perform that I'm comfortable right here. That's the only way I can stay sober. When I get food in a certain way right here, I'll get drunk. Now, I hear many people say that if you've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a while, you have to think to drink. I don't believe it. I don't think you have to do anything but quit doing the things that keep you comfortable right here. And you wake up drunk. Because, you see, you and I know a way to stop that big hurt. And if we allow it to hurt, like it used to hurt, we'll be just as drunk as we were in the old days. And we don't have to think about it at all. Just quit doing the things that keep us comfortable right here. Now, I agree with the doctors that alcoholism is a disease. I believe that it's terminal. I believe that it's a disease of twofold nature, an allergy to the body, coupled with an obsession in the mind. I accept all this. But I do not believe that that's all there is to the disease of alcoholism. If it is merely mental and physical, a good internist and a good psychiatrist could take me apart and put me back together, and I'd pick. But this doesn't very often happen to us. Once in a while, somebody gets sober and stays sober. But it doesn't often happen. So, there must be something else to this deal. A living problem. And we must have a living answer. And inasmuch as there has never been a mass recovering program for alcoholics that did not include a basic spiritual rest. Then it seems kindergarten to me that the problem behind the problem is a basic spiritual unrest. Now, I say often when I'm about ready to quit talking, the time has to come through in our lives when we come to see that if there be fault, it's mine. If there be fault, it's mine. And I say if there be fault because I don't believe there's fault. I believe that you and I are the victims of a combination of characteristics which came with us. That makes it impossible for us to integrate ourselves into the life that we're born into, into this so-called civilization that we're born into. And I look at myself and a few thousand of you people, and it seems that there's three characteristics that are common to all of us, so common that they're so easy to see. In every one of us, regardless of race, color, creed, religion or the lack of it, education or the lack of it, which side of the track we were born on, don't make any difference. Every alcoholic that I've ever known, almost throughout the world, is a perfectionist, an idealist, with a terrific drive for excellence that goes with perfectionism. It is this drive for excellence that brought about the cliché that you've heard ever since you were a little guy. This is the best mechanic we ever had in the shop, but the best lawyer that ever hit this part of the country, but the best stenographer we ever had in the office, but she can't get down till about other Tuesday or Wednesday. Thanks too much. Terrific drive for excellence. Professionalism. Now, professionalism is a beautiful characteristic or attribute when we learn how to live with it. But until we do, it kills us. It makes us set goals for ourselves that we cannot attain, and we're forever disappointed in our own performance. And it makes us demand more of those around us than they can put out. And it makes it necessary for us to make them over. Our wives and our kids and the people who work with us and so on. It's a killer until we learn how to live with perfectionism, idealism. And it's very evident in all of us. The second thing is that to a man, we were born with the interior awareness that life should be a good and a big and a beautiful thing. I knew when I was 6 years old that life should be like it is now. My insides proclaimed it. But I looked at it and it was cheap and it was dirty and it was ugly. And that was one of my biggest problems. I couldn't integrate myself in the life around me because I didn't like it. There was a scene that you remember in the days of Wine and Roses that just tears the heart out of me, and I haven't had a drink for 29 years. But every time I think of it, it does me in. This gal had come back to her husband's apartment. Tried to talk him into rejoining her in the drinking world. And he's gotten into Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was begging her to join him in this new way of life. And she was standing looking out the window, high above New York City. And she finally said to him, I can't. When I look out of this window, sober. It's cheap and it's dirty and it's ugly. And when I look out drunk, it's beautiful. For 25 years, the only way I could stand what I looked at was to be half in a bag. And that's one of my big problems. And yours. And lastly, there are many more, but we'll just use three. And this is the most incongruous thing you'll ever hear come out of the mouth of an alky. And I caution you not to speak of this to your psychiatrist. We are high sensitive people. Mary met them when they were laying in the garden. And the fish got up and slowly walked away. We're highly sensitive people. And that's the reason that the psychiatric world, from one end of the world to the next, has labeled us as being emotionally immature. Every one of them. We're emotionally immature. I don't believe it. I think that we have several times the capacity for feeling. But the psychiatrist has. The psychiatrist came in and found me lying here on the floor in front of my big window when this was drunk. I couldn't even sit up. Cried my eyes out over a beautiful sunset. Most of them are dirty. He don't know what's so damn pretty, I can't stand it. And again, I haven't had a drink for 29 years. But a year ago, I was down on the knobs above Louisville, Kentucky, along the Ohio River. I was in October, and the leaves had turned. It's the most beautiful sight on the face of the earth. All those beautiful colors. And miles on it. It's so beautiful. I sat there all alone in my car and bawled my eyes out. I pretty couldn't stand it. We're not emotionally immature. We are highly sensitive people. Now, as I've told many of you, I've been in prisons all over practically all over the world. Mostly as a guest. I could leave after a while. And most of them are Folsom. Now, Folsom is for habitual criminals. You can't get into Folsom for murder if it's the first time. You have to be a habitual criminal to get in Folsom. They tell me up there that the flawless that build up there in those rocks used to build in Capistrano. But the four-time losers. So they build up there in the stone wall around that place, huh? I stood there and talked to twice as many people, or three times as many people, and watched them cry right along with me. And the tears bouncing off their bellies, and they make no attempt to hide it. And it isn't because they're emotionally immature. It's because of the identity. They feel right here exactly like I do. And they cry with me and they laugh with me. And it isn't because they're emotionally mature. Now I'm convinced that people like us, when we get here, have all the characteristics for alcoholism except alcohol. All we have to do is add a little alcohol and we're off. Very few things can happen to us. From the time we're born, we're either going to be priests, preachers, or nuns, or hotheads or alcoholics. Because we cannot integrate ourselves into the life around us. And it's not because we don't want to, because we do. We want so much to be a part of. And we're forever apart from. And so, this is our problem, a basic spiritual unrest. Unfortunately, the teachers don't know the answers. I marry a few people. I think I told you I had two this week. Monday and Tuesday, I had dinner. 2 months ago, I was asked to give a little eulogy for a 16-year-old girl who had taken an overdose. Cocaine. That's the end thing down in my country now, cocaine. And she died. And I got out there to the place, the cemetery, because there was no chapel deal. It was just a graveside service. And that whole hill was covered with kids. I don't know how many, just a whole pile of kids, teenagers, on that hill. And I said to myself, this can't be just a regular deal. I've got to talk to these kids. And I talked first for a little bit with their parents. And a few older people that were there. And I told them that I didn't believe in death and why and so forth and so on. And then I started talking to kids. And I told them I had great empathy for them. Because I too had been born into a society that I couldn't swallow. I couldn't integrate myself into. And I had to find a way to be comfortable, because I was not comfortable in society in which I had to move. And when I was 19, I found a way to get comfortable in that society. And for the next 15 years, I used this chemical for an answer. And it was an answer. For the first 15 years. But after 15 years, my answer turned on me and became a problem. And in the next 10 years, it made it necessary for me to find the right answer. And I did. And then I told these kids that if they could just come to stay with us. I said, when you're behind the acid, you got all the answers. But when the acid's gone, you ain't got none. The answer's gone too, you see. But there was an answer that stays with you. And it's so much better than any chemical that you can put in your body that you can sing about your business of living. And you don't have to repeat a dosage of chemicals. And if you just decide that you want to find this answer and make an effort, you can find it. And there are many people that have helped you. And if you do this, maybe this life will be, this death will be justified. Her mother called me the early part of the week. First time since I had been there. And she said there was quite a movement amongst the teachers and amongst the students to find an answer to replace this stuff. And she told me about some guy that's throwing his house open to kids there in Laguna Beach. And they wanted me to come down there last Friday, but I had to do something else, and I couldn't go. Friday week. But isn't that beautiful that they might now be looking for something that might take the place of this chemical deal? And I want to close with this little story. Before Alcoholics Anonymous was born, there was a chaplain named Roland. And Roland was an alkie. And Roland was doctoring with Dr. Carl Jung, who might possibly be the greatest psychological mind that the world has produced so far. If I was learned, that would be a good opinion, but I'm not. But to me, he was tops. He was the same visage as Freud and Adler and Jung. But it seems that Jung had a personal answer. He had a living answer, and maybe the others didn't. And Roland was doctoring with him. And every time he came back to him, he was worse. And he finally came back to him, Dr. Jung. And the doctor told him, he says, medical science has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. Psychiatry has done everything in its power for you, and it can do no more. And that's my duty to tell you that your only hope is to find a spiritual experience that might save you. Your only chance. Now, this was some little time before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. And eventually, Eddie called on Mel. And eventually, Bill heard the pronouncement that we've talked about already. He might have six more months to live, and then his wife would have to either lock him up or bury him. And he called out, God, if there be a God, reveal yourself to me now. And something happened. And he got sober. And he shared this thing pretty well until he died. Never had drinking. Now, after he and Dr. Bob and some of the rest of them had worked out this formula and had proven that it worked, if you and I work it, and had put it in this book for us, Bill heard about Roland and his what Dr. Jung had told him about the spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience being his only chance. And Bill wrote to Dr. Carl Jung in Zurich, Switzerland. And he asked him in the letter, how come he had known enough about alcoholism to so counsel Roland as he had done? And Dr. Jung wrote back, and he told Bill, in essence, that he had always known that the alcoholic's problem was his search for unity. His search for unity, and he couldn't find it. He even quoted one of my favorite verses. As the heart, H-A-R-T, as the heart panteth after the water brook, so panteth my soul after thee, O God. He'd always known that this was the alcoholic's problem. His attempt to find unity with the life around him and with the God that made him. And when he found the bottle, it seemed to be the missing ingredient. It seemed to let him live a little bit more comfortably with himself and in the society around him. And he had found chemical unity. And it did a pretty good job with him until it became the problem. That only a spiritual answer could solve. Now that's a beautiful thing. And most of us agree with it. Now here's what happened. And this just curled my hair. This is fantastic. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to me. Roland, having heard this, affiliated himself with the Oxford movement and got sober. And he ran into Eddie. And he got Eddie into the Oxford movement. And Eddie got sober. And Eddie called on Bill. And Bill got sober. And so the finger of God. Oh, this is so beautiful. In our entire history, the finger of God is so evident all the way through. From Dr. Carl Jung to Roland to Eddie to Bill. Bill to Dr. Bob, and Bob to Dr. Bob, and Bill to us. What a beautiful thing it is. And how fortunate are we, I believe us to be, the most fortunate segment of humanity, of God's kids. Because, you see, we have to. We have to find an answer lest we die. You come here not looking for God or to get her wives back or to get the lover for her kids back. Not even looking for help in many cases, like my own. But just a way to live one day at a time without drinking so that we might rub out a little of the record. And we find that the formula for sobriety and the formula for the good life and the formula of God are all the same. And we find an answer that makes the chemical unnecessary. And it's an answer that don't stay in the meaty.
When we leave, it goes with us. I'm never alone anymore. How fortunate can a man be? God bless you. Thank you very much.